Welcome, everyone, to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. We are in paper 74, section 4, which is old single column, page 832. Okay, recall where we left off in the preceding session. That preceding section, they had taken us through the first 6 days of Adam and Eve, not post-arrival, of course, but post-awakening, you know, after being rematerialized. So their first first 6 days conscious on our world. And, of course, that fact that there was 6 days to that process of the initial orientation stuff, followed by what we're about to read about on the seventh day, as the revelators stress at the end of this paper, that made a huge lasting impression that carried all the way to the first chapter of Genesis, right? All the way to that first creation story in the Old Testament, and having creation occur, be spanned over 7 days, or 6 days with followed by a day of rest. And recall about that, that so-called day of rest, that's exactly, what Adam and Eve had planned to do, as they were telling us just as we were wrapping up section 3, that they were just going to take a breather and kind of just let it all settle in for a day and then get to work. But no. after 6 bedazzling days, the mortals on the planet, even these selected ones that were in the garden that you'd think would have a little bit of, would have gotten used to kind of fancy stuff, if you will, a little bit more than the run-of-the-mill mortal, you'd think that they could handle this, but no. It's just overwhelming them emotionally, and it all comes to a head. So that's the upheaval that they're mentioning here in the title. And we'll have a number of, as we're reading tonight, there will be a number of, everyone kind of knows, is familiar with these papers, there's a number of kind of basically scientific statements that are tossed in between the lines that are head scratchers, and we'll see if we can ponder those a little bit. You may recall there's midwares involved here in this section here, for instance, is the first one. So let's jump in, see what they have here for us.
That night, the night following the sixth day, while Adam and Eve slumbered, strange things were transpiring in the vicinity of the Father's temple in the central sector of Eden. There, under the rays of the mellow moon, hundreds of enthusiastic and excited men and women listened for hours to the impassioned pleas of their leaders. They meant well, but they simply could not understand the simplicity of the fraternal and democratic manner of their new rulers. And long before daybreak, the new and temporary administrators of world affairs reached a virtually unanimous conclusion that Adam and his mate were altogether too modest and unassuming. They decided that divinity had descended to earth in bodily form, that Adam and Eve were in reality gods, or else so near such an estate as to be worthy of reverent worship.
Okay, so like I was saying, you can see that hundreds of enthusiastic you know, and excited men and women. Like I said, the emotion is just, you know, reached a boiling point here. It's just so profound, so so transcendent of ordinary experience. Just, you know, like, remember even just how incredibly knowledgeable Adam and Eve were of genetics, and hence of the innate behavior of animals. Just all those things. They were just overawed.
Not to mention they were 8 foot tall and they
glowed. All these things. It just, you know, it built up to the point where they just, yeah.
There was no way out for these guys. From the start.
But, you know, that immediate stuff, you know, aside, you know, just notice the way, you know, remember Salonia's writing these papers. You know, the way she selects words. They decided that divinity, okay, first you notice it's divinity and not deity, but you notice it's a capitalized D instead of a lowercase d. So this, you know, the precision is still in play, even when you're talking about something that's very emotional, you know, and fraught with feelings. The author is still giving you this very precise description. You go, well, okay, first of all, why would she say divinity and not deity? Well, remember, divinity means deity-like. You know, or divinity, you know, divine means deity-like, divinity, deity-likeness. And you notice it says they were in reality gods or else so near such an estate. I see, so... it's appropriate to describe that thought, you know, as divinity, deity-like. And, but very much as, you know, the people are thinking, you know, they descended to earth, right? That this is very much a top-down thing, not a bottom-up thing that they're visualizing, and kind of even more so with the capitalization. You know, it's deity. Or, I mean, it's the divinity made substance, right? Just like they're saying there, right? And descended to earth in bodily form. You know, it's like when you consider whether or not they capitalize deity or not in the book, right? And capital D deity, you know, is referring to the literal stuff, deity. It's not a, you know, it's not just using the word deity as a quality word, you know, it's a qualifier, descriptor, but, you know, it's literally talking about there's this stuff, this deity stuff that you can make a being out of, and if you personalize that, that's personalized deity, that's God. Okay, yeah, but every once in a while they do the same thing with the word divinity, see, and capitalize it like this. So, just even though that seems like an aside, it's every chance I get, I try to remind you that if you want to really get to the truth of the revelation, if you want to get your mind in that wholehearted synchronization, right, you can't be just attuning. You know, let's give you the full benefit of the doubt. You can't be just attuning the sixth level of meaning, the ceiling of the heart, right? That's not wholehearted, right? You also need the floor, fourth level of meaning. So in other words, you need scientific consciousness as well as religious consciousness from the sixth level, right? And everything in between. Right? You need the floor and the ceiling, and hence, you know, encompassing the whole to be wholehearted. You have to have your precise mind working at the same time that you have that full unity consciousness in play. The two eyes have to both be open and dynamically in play, so that you can have this super additive consequence of recognition that gives you that. That synthetic space where you can strike step with the truth. Okay.
So honestly, you know, the degree of intelligence of these people, you really even think they had a concept of divinity? Mm-hmm. Or...
Well, yeah, and again, you can bring in that point. You know, remember, the authors are always describing the reality of what is going on, not how things appeared necessarily to the primitive people in play or whatever. I mean, even, you know, you really see that when you go to part four, like especially some of the sections where Jesus and Ganon are going around the Mediterranean, you know, like take Discourse on Reality, say. Right? I mean, they're not giving you literally what Jesus said, you know, so in other words, how it appeared, but they're giving you the reality of what he was speaking to in a mode that is appropriate for the fifth epical revelation, not 2,000 years ago and Jesus talking to a young Indian lad, you know, or whatever, right? But they're giving you the they're giving you the but just to kind of complete that for everyone's benefit, you know, to give you that that level of challenged engagement of reality, so that you can get the kind of truth. You need to, I mean, see, they're telling you that it's not going to be adequate for you to engage what Jesus said at the level Ganon did. It's not going to be adequate here for you to, you know, be thinking about it merely in the terms that those people did 38,000 years ago. The point is for you to engage it at a deeper level so that... a more consequential truth is available to you, right? Because the truths that are available to people 38,000 years ago are not going to solve the emergency on the planet right now, right? You can't have the swizzle stick of truth. You need the fire hose of truth, okay, to solve the problems of the day. So, again, see, that's why, you know, it's not because I'm trying to, you know, I have an obsession in being pedantic or something, right? I mean, you have to recognize that it's important. There's nothing that's arbitrary in the book. The tiniest detail is something very important, you know, and waiting to be recognized. So, but nonetheless, now back to the immediacy of the historical event here. We all know they love to do this in the story of Adam and Eve. Under the rays of the mellow moon, right? they love to give you this poetic setting, you know, description of the scene. Just to remind you again of how the scene, you can get caught up in it, and it can be difficult for even a material son and daughter to not kind of get swept up in the feeling of the moment, right? You know, it's like, no, you need to stay clear-headed and not get, you know, kind of fuzzed out by the fact that it's a mellow moon, you know, and it's this beautiful still evening, you know, and all this, right? That's why they do that. They're just trying to, you know, get you to better recognize how even the environment is kind of conspiring to have things go off the rails here, with these people. Everything is just so that they just, you know, they're just overwhelmed. Even the weather seems to obey their presence. It's like a perfect evening. And I mean, you just see, that's what they're thinking, right?
Everything in appearance.
Yeah. How could they not be gods? Let's see here. Anything else there? The new and temporary administrators. Remember, they're already in this mode where they're trying to figure out exactly what kind of a temporary administration. Remember, we read that last time, you know, they're going to have until the Melchizedek's leave. And right, and so you already have some kind of officialdom, right, you know, in play too, right? just adds to it. All right. Let's keep going.
The amazing events of the first 6 days of Adam and Eve on Earth were entirely too much for the unprepared minds of even the world's best men. Their heads were in a whirl. They were swept along with the proposal to bring the noble pair up to the Father's temple on high at high noon, in order that everyone might bow down in respectful worship and prostrate themselves in humble submission. And the garden dwellers were really sincere in all of this.
Okay, so kind of the meat is just in that very last one, right? You know, just, you know, that's where it should remind, you know, you should be reminded of some things in your own life. Sure. No one is questioning their sincerity here. But be careful that you don't think, well, I mean, I'm sincere, so my thoughts are by definition right. It's very easy to think that. Right? People do it all the time. Right? We know that's going to play a role in the story coming up, right? We are so sincere. I mean, right, everything has to be right and true and good and, right. Nothing possibly could go wrong with such humble sincerity, right? You know, they want to prostrate themselves.
So that's important.
Right? Yeah, it is important, but it's just...
Sincerity is sincerity.
Yeah, but, you know...
Those things are important.
But it doesn't make... It isn't a substitute for wisdom. Right? Ooh. You know, it isn't a substitute for having all of the big picture, like they were pointing out there. It was entirely too much, right? Their capacity was too small, right? They were filled up, and it was bursting at the seams inside. They just couldn't hold this.
You know? It falls in the category of necessary but not sufficient.
Yes, necessary but not sufficient, yes. And we're just seeing that all the time. We saw that last time with Adam and Eve. It's like all of the education, all of the experience, well, that's all necessary but not sufficient to keep you from going off the rails. And so,
but they knew about high noon.
Yeah, and yeah, when we were reminded of how just the fact that they arrived, that gives this whole mythology to noon, right, in human history. The fact that you have this seraphic, you know, linkage to that communications, you know, at that time and all sorts of things. So, we just, you know, you're, in between the lines, you're getting all of the, you know, kind of where the oomph behind our mythology came from. Let's see. Anything else there?
Too much for the unprepared minds. You know? I think that's key in a way in terms of what you're saying. I mean, mm-hmm. Like, the whole thing to me, rather than all the reading a lot into it, is I'm really trying to set the picture for you that these guys were totally overawed.
Yeah.
And they've been waiting for this for a long time, we all know, and so almost naturally they came to this conclusion and wanted to do this.
Mm-hmm.
And then Adam and Eve, you know, said,
Yeah.
But we all remember the story, but, you know, you can see why they would. One would
Sure. Yeah, and again, you know, you just reflect on those details like unprepared. It's like, well, how does that apply to me? How's not just something that's relative to this? Think about it. You get universal bestowal of thought adjusters in people like this. Right? We're the same, basically. Not that big a difference, really. What if you got your wish... I want to get a definitive communication from my thought adjuster. I want to get that close that I can hear the still small voice. Well, what if you got your wish? Are you prepared for that? Oh, I don't have to be prepared. It's innately divine and everything, and nothing could go wrong. No, everything can go wrong. Right? You know, you have
so that you don't get it till you're
ready to get it. Yeah, see, that, you know, you go, oh, that's probably why there's like 7 cosmic levels to get to that point normally, so that you're prepared. Right. Yeah, see, yeah, so you know, you have to recognize that there's no magic here. If you don't have the mind physics that's been growing into you over time through, you know, tribulation-induced experiential wisdom, you're not going to handle it. You can't assimilate. It will just fry all your circuitry. Okay? Yeah.
We're also anticipating the magisterial son coming to this planet.
Yeah.
Will he find prepared minds when he comes? Everyone's mind being a plural.
Yeah. Right, I mean, you know that this is one of the things in play, both with you know, the magisterial sons sometime in the not-too-distant future arrival, not to mention Machiaventi Melchizedek, assuming planetary prince. I mean, you know that part of their calculation about this, about when they're going to do this, is, you know, we can't have everything just totally blown up, you know, by us stepping in like this so definitively. I mean, you know, I mean, they can't be revolutional, even though they kind of are. See, that's the challenge. How can you, as a revelator, how can you be evolutional but not revolutional? And that's, you know, that gets us back to this story right here. See, that's Adam and Eve quickly recognized, whoa, this is getting out of hand. This is turning into a revolution, you know, in their minds. We need to tamp this down and get everyone settled in for a long, gradual evolutionary process. Right? Magisterial son isn't going to come and wave his magic wand and there will be 7th stage light and life on every corner of the planet. Okay? Machiaventi is not going to do it. If Michael comes again, he's not going to do that. No one is going to do that. No one's going to revolutionize the planet. If they tried it, they would be in rebellion. Gee, what would happen if a master son went into rebellion? That might have serious consequences. Right, it's not going to happen. Right, so right, we all need to, you know, think about how can I have a state of mind that can handle some spiritualization without flying off on a tangent? How can I prevent fanaticism in my mind? And I kind of said it early on. I mean, it's a big process, but step one, as they tell you, you know, they talk specifically about that, you know, the physics of fanaticism, you know, in various spots in the book. I mean, step one is, you have to have as much scientific consciousness as religious consciousness, right? If they're not balanced, I see, that's the starting point. I mean, everything, you know, builds from there, and there's philosophic after that. But just the starting point, you see, and you can literally picture that in the hourglass analogy, right? The floor, you have to be grounded on the fourth level of meaning, right? You know, and by scientific consciousness, I don't mean you know how to do, you know, integrals or something, okay? You know, or you're great at building measuring devices, you know, or, I don't know. I mean, that's not what scientific consciousness means. So the word science means knowledge. You have the ability to penetrate through the appearance of information and get to the reality of knowledge, and you're grounded in that. That's the rock that Jesus was telling you to build on. Right? You have to be solidly grounded like that, or otherwise nothing else will go well. Okay. So,
weren't these guys, you know, completely disillusioned just prior to
yeah,
prior?
Right.
So
yeah.
Then they had this big, roller coaster, to help unbalance them.
Right. And we all know that you can transfer this basic dynamics up into the Jesus story, and Jesus was constantly struggling with this exact same dynamic, trying to keep them, you know, to be on a more even keel. You know, they get all, you know, and then they drop like a rock, you know. It's like, you know, they're just, you know, in this ever more sort of unstable, even violent oscillation in their mind. Try to get them to stabilize themselves.
And look what it was, simplicity of fraternal and democratic manner.
Yeah.
Like, that's all it takes to trip you guys up, is just that we're pretty chill about everything?
Well, no, I mean, you know, they were just, you know, they thought that was just, you know, this is just totally inappropriate. I mean, I don't want you, I want you on a pedestal. Right?
It can't be at eye level.
Yeah. All right. You're too humble. You're too, you know.
Yeah. Just stop.
I want the full thing. I want the fancy vestments. Yeah. I want the Rolls Royce with the gold bumpers. You know, I want the whole works, right? I want the full effect. So just, you know, that's why that shtick works. Yeah. We just genetically, you know, are drawn to that, or, you know, are impressed by that.
We're soft on it.
Right? Okay. What else do they say here?
Van protested. Amadon was absent, being in charge of the guard of honor, which had remained behind with Adam and Eve overnight. But Van's protest was swept aside. He was told that he was likewise too modest, too unassuming, that he was not far from a god himself. Else, how had he lived so long on earth? And how had he brought about such a great event as the advent of Adam? And as the excited Edenites were about to seize him and carry him up to the mount for adoration, Van made his way out through the throng, and being able to communicate with the midwayers, sent their leader in great haste to Adam.
And that interesting little shade of Jesus, you know, going through the crowd.
Yeah.
You know, Van doing the same thing there. Yeah. So
you send a midwayer in great haste.
Yeah, and so at the end there, you remember, Van and Amadon can see all, you know, lower spiritual beings and stuff. So can Adam and Eve. You know, so all the midwayers and the Lananadex and everything else, those are all visible, you know, all seraphim and whatnot. And, you know, this, you know, you're puzzled how this hasn't been a dynamic for 150,000 years with Van and Amadon. I mean, you know, and how did they keep from being thought of basically as gods? I mean, you know, everyone knows that they've been living here for 500,000 years, you know, or 450,000 years anyway, right? And how you keep that tamped down, you know, amongst the people, that must have been an interesting dynamic. For a long time, but you know, here it all comes to a head again, and you know, and again, very like John was saying, understandably so. I mean, you know, how could you think matter of factly about someone that you know? Right? I mean, it'd be very difficult not to put them on a pedestal in your mind, right?
At the same time, they're basically dismissing their recommendations about. Mm-hmm. It's like, okay, so if you really think highly of me, listen to what I'm telling you.
Yeah.
You know.
But Van's protest was swept aside.
Right.
It's weird. Yeah.
You're one of them.
You know, yeah, we're not looking for revelation here, we're looking for affirmation. Yeah. You know, and you know, they, obviously they point out that Amadon was absent. Otherwise, you know, he's obviously being thought of in the same way as Van. Because after all these years, remember, he's, you know, his genetics is, you know, has been radically modified by being, you know, plugged into this energy input by the master physical controllers, you know, using the fruit of the tree of life. Yeah, so he's a very majestic individual like Van, too. They're both going to be very just biologically impressive individuals. Perfect chiseled forms, you know. I mean, they would just been very impressive. Okay.
It was near the dawn of their seventh day on Earth that Adam and Eve heard the startling news of the proposal of these well-meaning but misguided mortals. And then, even while the passenger birds were swiftly winging to bring them to the temple, the midwayers, being able to do such things, transported Adam and Eve to the Father's temple. It was early on the morning of the seventh day, and from the mount of their so recent reception, that Adam held forth in explanation of the orders of the divine sonship, and made clear to these earth minds that only the Father and those whom he designates may be worshipped. Adam made it plain that he would accept any honor and receive all respect, but worship never.
Exclamation point. It's always fun when the revelators use an exclamation point. Okay, so we'll get to the science, the mystery in there in a second. Okay, what else do we have in there? I'll point to the little details. I often emphasize when you see the MIS prefix on a word, don't think of that flippantly like humans do. Like, you know, we call something misspelled. No. The mis prefix means wrong. Okay? Righteousness and unrighteousness are not in play in what letters are in your word. Okay, that's a extreme over-aggrandizement of what's going on there with that improper spelling. Okay, and when the revelators use miss, they mean miss. So wrong-guided mortals, they're pointing out that this isn't just mere confusion. That this has the seeds of a sweeping disruption of relationship to the cosmos and what's in play here, in the minds of these individuals. In the same way that, I always point out, as soon as Jesus caught the slightest little bit of pride, creeping into his disciples, he came down on them like a ton of bricks, right, with an exclamation point. Because he knows it gets out of hand very quick. It goes to these sorts of things, this unwise relationship to spiritual energy in your mind goes to evil quickly. And it needs to be taken hold of. You got to find a bridle and you got to put it on and you got to grab the reins quick and pull back on the reins. Okay, so... and again, it's like, well, yeah, but they're well-meaning. So how could anything go wrong? You see it right there. See, they're trying to challenge you. Okay.
this is very challenging for us because Jesus, after he healed the blind man, I'm remembering the biblical account. And there was the whole story about the officials asking him, how did he receive his sight and so forth? And anyway, when he found Jesus, he fell down and worshipped him. Mm-hmm. And Jesus accepted that.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't discourage him or turn him. He did not do what Adam and Eve are doing here.
Right. Why?
Because he is deity.
Right, because he is personalized deity post-baptism. Right? He is God.
But I'm saying it's challenging because it is different.
Yeah. Right, you see, and it's challenging. I often point this out. That's the an example of the tricky aspect of the public ministry of Jesus. Right? You have to very carefully keep the true man and the true God separated, and sometimes that's very difficult to do. It's, so, I mean, you can. There's lots of ways you can get tripped up in interpreting the events of the public ministry. You know, and it'll take you off on false tangents. Yeah, that's why, you know, pre-baptism, like, you know, especially the trip around the Mediterranean, that is just such an incredible gift to us. Okay? Because you don't have that problem in play. That is just man. Right? There's no God, you know, there. That's just Jesus, right? True man. Jesus the man. You know, and all of that is directly relevant to you. Right, the religious life of Jesus and how he lived it, right? Not the religious life of Michael. That is that'll get you way off on false tangents, right? You need the religious life of Jesus, and that's not immediately apparent in the public ministry story. Okay, but it's right there, unpolluted, if you will. You have to use such a strong word, unconfused. Prior to the baptism. Yeah, but you can notice that they give you very little of Jesus' second circler, Jesus' first circler. Okay. Because, again, that starts to get a little bit inappropriate, right, and confusing. Right? I mean, you shouldn't have any goal in mind right now. You know, not the Isle of Paradise, not really. The goal you should have in your mind right now is third circler. First things first. That's really the only thing that, you know, there's any potential for you to have some appropriate imagining of and to be directing yourself towards in a true way. Your imaginings beyond that, you know, are going to get further offline, and it's first things first.
Isn't that the basic attainable available to us anyway? Because yeah. You're at eye level with the grace level.
Yeah.
Is that level.
Right. It's just that's what's appropriate. I mean, to get to the point where you walking through life is indistinguishable from the story of Jesus going around the Mediterranean. The way you interact with everyone is exactly like that. That's your first goal. That's just trivial step one. I mean, think about how far a finality is behind, you know, beyond that. Yeah. I mean, you know, we're impressed by Jesus the third circler. I mean, yeah, but that's, you know, you're so far beyond that when you leave Gerizim, for instance. Yeah. Right? You've gone way beyond that level of quality of mind that you're seeing there. I mean, that's just child's play. But it's, you know, to us it seems like it's almost impossible to even imagine us being that in the moment, you know, that, you know, just holistic with people and just, right. Yeah, that's a third circler. Okay.
But Chris,
yep.
You're the one who came up with the ellipse.
No, oh, no, right, I mean, there's a difference.
Excuse me.
There's a difference
you're
between.
Me.
No, no. Yeah, but okay. So let's explain that. There's a difference
between.
She's wondering. It's like, well, what do we do with everything in the book or everything that I've
imagine, like,
I've done beyond third circler, like thinking about the infinite, eternal ellipse of total deity and stuff like that, right? I mean, or even paper 105, deity and reality. I mean, that's way beyond the doings of a third circler. Right. It's. I'm just talking about your. You know what's. What are you trying to? Not what are you trying to. Get. An intellectual comprehension of. But what are you? What is your immediate growth goal? You know. I'm supplying favorable conditions. First, to be grown into a third circler. Right. Just me, the experiential being, and how I interact with others in the outer life, that's that goal. what I'm doing in my inner life and getting to the point where I can think with a high enough quality of reflective thinking in my inner life to see the truths flowing through the infinite eternal ellipse of total deity, okay, that's a separate matter. That's you in your inner life.
Mm-hmm. Right? But it has to do, you were mentioning imagination.
Yeah.
The book makes it so we can imagine, like, all the way to that.
Yeah, we can imagine.
Life, too, also helps with imagination and inspiration.
We can imagine the reality of those things, but we can't imagine the way we will experientially behave. Just remember what they say, that you can't even imagine the kind of behavior amongst the humans on a normal post-bestowal world. It's just so beyond your imagination. See, because that's, you know, that's kind of over the horizon right now for you, in terms of extrapolation of your experiential, you know, day-to-day living nature. But see, you know, I don't have to try to somehow take the truths of deity and bring them down and out as some sort of experiential manifestation in the outer life. Right? That's not the point of trying to figure out paper 105. Right? It's about just getting that inner life more synchronized with the cosmos. It supplies, in a higher sense, a favorable condition for you to be grown from seventh circular to sixth circular to fifth circular, etc. Right? But you're not immediately applying that in your outer life.
But it's flavor. Deity flavors everything.
It does, right? See, it does. You can recognize that, but just,
and, you know, however it does, like, I don't consciously try to do that, but it's doing it.
I mean, did Jesus talk about, the absinthe upholder to anyone during his Mediterranean tour?
I would have loved
see? To see. See, you notice that he didn't, see. All right, but
after a while, they do say terms like that.
Okay, right. But I'm just trying to get you to appreciate there's the inner life and the outer life, and you have to, you know, don't blur that together. Okay.
Speaking about the outer life.
Yes,
speaking about
the outer. Okay, so let's get to this. Yeah, this interesting outer life issue, this scientific issue. What are they referring to here? So we know that we had the passenger birds. You know, remember they, everything is, Van and Amidon have apparently been keeping everything with them going fine. You know, it's only after the fault and Adam and Eve are dead and gone, then the Fandors die out. You know, about 30,000 years ago. But everything is still going fine, you know, with the passenger birds. And so they were flying on them before, and the birds somehow have been directed to head towards Adam and Eve's home. The midwayers are saying, no, it's going to take too long, and they jump in. And that's where the mystery is. I mean, the midwares being able to do such things. Just one of a handful of things that they say about the midwares, where they give you just enough of a comment to be frustrated and not enough to really figure out the physics that they're referring to. It's obvious that, you know, it's a violation of the revelatory mandate to give us anything very specific here. But let's think about what we know. Remember, these are primary midwayers here, not secondary. So their relationship to, you know, matter as we understand it, you know, what's going on as I reach over and pick up this cup, you know, and I have a molecular to molecular interaction with that cup. I mean, the secondary midwayers, you know, when they put themselves in that mode, you know, you can think about it very much being just like you picking up the cup. With the primary midwives, this is not the case. It's much more mysterious. Now, they tell you that the primary midwives can engage material things, but, you know, some way not as directly, you know, as a secondary midwife. It's like, well, how then do they engage material things? I mean, I think you can get a little hint of that when you think about what they say about the secondary midwives. The fact that, for instance, a secondary midwife can manipulate material things and he doesn't have to make himself visible to do it. Right? You know, not only can my hand grab this cup, but you can see me grabbing the cup. Right? Those go hand in hand, pardon the pun, right, with us. But not so with a midwife, secondary midwife. Well, see, it must, the primary midwives must do their engaging in that less immediate way, right? That the secondaries can do a little bit too. And the key is, remember when we talked about the midwives, a lot of times you think of midwives, well, they're kind of like another flavor of angel. Yes and no. I mean, they're on the one hand, they're a flavor of kind of a lower angel, you know, angel type being, but they're also just as much a power being down at a low level.
Yeah.
Okay, they're a power personality synthesis being innately. They're not offspring of the third source and center, right? They're of the supreme.
So you think it'd be like a transporter, like beam me up, Scotty?
No, I don't. No, so it's not going to be.
Because it's material bodies here. They're not.
Now, the thing that we. Yeah, I was just going to get to that. I mean, you're wondering, it's like, okay, well, do they have technology? Right? I mean, are they doing this just, you know, with, you know, it's just merely their bodies and their ability to manipulate things? Like, I mean, are they. Can they do some kind of like anti-gravity thing to Adam and Eve, you know, and transport them? Or, you know, in the same way that a secondary midwayer might be overruling some of the normal gravity, you know, state of affairs with some large object? Or do they have any sort of technology? I mean, so with this secondary midwives, you can think that definitely as they go forward, they would have gone through kind of a technological development where at some point they probably had airplanes, you know, and would use that. Then eventually they have much more sophisticated craft, right? Especially if they bring in the non-breathers, right, you know, to work with them and all that sort of stuff. You know, the non-breathers have anti-gravity technology and all this sort of stuff. You know, not to mention interplanetary, you know, craft. And you know, you see, you don't know for sure if it's being done with the aid of some technology. Do they have some device that, you know, some sort of a thing that Adam and Eve can be put on that goes faster than a bird flies? Or are they somehow doing this themselves? I mean, it's not like a transporter. It's not like they're dematerializing them and rematerializing them. They definitely can't do that. But they, you know, they tell you that the midwayers have the ability to control physical things, you know, in a lesser way, the same way that a physical controller controls physical things. See, they're a low level power being in some way, and we just don't know exactly what the details are because they obviously aren't allowed to tell us, right? So all we get is that annoyingly, you know, vague statement of being able to do such things.
How many miles away was their home to the site?
It's just going to be, you know, a few miles, and it's all in that, you know, that garden area, you know.
Fandor was too slow for the occasion.
What I get from this is it's innate in their
Yeah.
They don't have to
can try
to have developed the technology to do this. But that's just my
opinion. My first guess is it's probably sans technology. It's probably, you know, it's without technology. They can't self-transport. So it's not that. It's not that they can be a. You're just left wondering exactly how this works. Remember, you can throw in a really, difficult to assimilate fact. At one point, they tell you in the book that, in terms of midwares, what their relationship to space and time is, they can potentially be involved in a transport phenomenon at twice the speed of light. They aren't as fully within relationship to space and time as we are. They have half the relationship to it that we do.
Yeah.
Right? There's three dimensions two of them are kind of locked in like it is for us, but one dimension is fully transcendent and can be at full unit speed. What does that mean? That just adds to. But it's not like they're somehow transporting Adam and Eve at twice the speed of light or anything like that. Just in terms of how would they relate to physical phenomena and being able to do these things. They're doing that in a very top down way. They're innately. Their nature is transcendent of the situation in a way that we can't understand. They're not down in there and having to, like the bird is, right? And having to go through space,
They didn't have a chopper.
They can engage the situation in some sort of a transcendent way, but they obviously can't drag Adam and Eve up into that transcendence. Adam and Eve are fully down in things just like us, So I'm just trying to get you to think about how there's no way we're going to be able to think about exactly what the physics of this is. But it's pretty wide open in terms of speculative potential. In terms of how transcendently they can relate to physical things.
They change their physical location.
Right, and they somehow took a hold of them got them from point A to point B in some very swift way.
They modified a state, and then they could grab it or something.
You don't know if this is, from that transcendent engagement of matter, does it allow, some kind of measure of delocalization, relocalization to some degree, and yet not transcendent, not totally transcendent? I don't know. It kind of immediately gets into this mysterious space of, take a seraphim. Take the author of this paper. Take Solonia. Exactly how does she relate to the dirt on the ground or the floor of this room? There's lots of mystery to this, right? There's spots in the book when they talk about, that angels are getting around not in a transport sense. It's not like they have to get into a transport seraphim, to go from London to New York, okay? But there's apparently some ability to kind of delocalize and relocalize in a different locale.
Yeah.
See, in a way that isn't, that seems magical to us, right? But it's because we just really don't understand, what the universe of the physical universe is. We think of it as a universe of matter, right? And it's all just static and sitting there. But it's really not. It's really a universe of motion, in a way that we just can't imagine right now. You know, and how location is related to that is very mysterious to us.
It seems like any being that is closer to the mother, who is in all places, is able to move about in a different way, you know, quicker. And so just that, there's probably, I don't know how, but it seems like there's a connection.
Yeah, I remember that. We, you know, we do know that, for instance, any being that can transport itself, right, including like a transport seraphim, the reason they can do that, you know, be they transport seraphim or divine counselor or finaliter, is because they have a relationship to the whole very directly, to the Trinity. Right? Trinity origin beings can do that, for instance, innately. You know, and that's the special thing about, unlike the run-of-the-mill seraphim, say, that is just a child of the third source and center, the transport seraphim are that, plus they have some sort of backdoor relationship to the Paradise Trinity that's allowing them to be a being that can move through space by themselves. Remember how when we were talking about all those beings in those early papers, it's all a manifestation of this coupling between the Paradise Trinity and the Infinite Spirit, that pairing. And so some beings are kind of a direct expression of the Paradise Trinity. Some beings are a direct expression of the Infinite Spirit. Yeah. Some get one or the other in kind of a backdoor way because, right, because it's always that way. I mean, if you're coming out of the Infinite Spirit, right, behind that fact is the Paradise Trinity. Or if you're coming out of the Paradise Trinity, behind that is the Infinite Spirit. You know, all those beings are being generated out of that coupling.
They could have had some machine with a cloaking device.
You know? Anyway.
Let's move quickly.
Yeah.
Anyway, they got him there.
Yeah, just one other little comment about the reason that I'm kind of biased away from thinking they have like some sort of craft is, I mean, everything else in the book seems to indicate that that the Midwayers you know, have this sort of have an evolutionary culture like we do, and that it doesn't move at some extremely faster pace in the evolution of technology of them. I mean, that's kind of why in a normal world the Midwayers and the mortals are not brought together until you get to Light and Life. I mean, but if you've got a non-breather world in the same solar system, right, they have very advanced technology at a very early stage in their planet's history. And so that's a very different thing. But I think normally, you know, like say maybe, you know, a few thousand years ago, the Midwayers probably developed airplanes, right, or something like that. That's kind of more what you'd kind of think, right?
But does it go alongside of us?
Yeah, and so they have a whole evolution of their technology and culture parallel to us. You know, not, you know, locked to us, you know, but it's not magical. It takes a long time for them to develop stuff too, and normally. So anyway, you know, we're back making brick walls and stuff here, right? You know, so right, it's not like they have, you know, advanced metallurgy, you know, they're making craft or something like that. That I don't think is, you know, the way it's working. That'd be my guess anyway. Okay. All right. So anyway, being able to do such things. Meanwhile, back to the upheaval. Adam and Eve got there, and they got there very quickly. So now what?
It was a momentous day, and just before noon, about the time of the arrival of the seraphic messenger bearing the Gerasim acknowledgement of the installation of the world's rulers, Adam and Eve, moving apart from the throng, pointed to the Father's temple and said, "Go you now to the material emblem of the Father's invisible presence and bow down in worship of Him who made us all and who keeps us living. And let this act be the sincere pledge that you never will again be tempted to worship anyone but God." They all did as Adam directed. The material son and daughter stood alone on the mount with bowed heads while the people prostrated themselves about the temple.
Okay. So interesting little aside. You notice how there's kind of asides on all of everyone's prayer. Right at the beginning there, right, we don't have the circuits. Right? So you wouldn't have that immediate acknowledgement from Gerizim that would have come normally, you know, through the circuits right when they were installed. You know, so everything back, you know, and remember it's a 5-year, you know, length of time to get from Gerizim to here by seraphic transport. So you know, everyone on Gerizim is having to anticipate, right? They sent this message off 5 years prior to it arriving here, see? they sent off Adam and Eve by seraphic transport, right? You know, and then a few days later, they sent off the acknowledgement, see? You know, right? Because they can't do everything kind of in real time because they don't have the circuits.
And they show up at noon.
Yes, and of course, the seraphim always show up at noon.
World rulers.
Yeah, so remember we mentioned that they are definitely, because there isn't a planetary prince, you know, more than normal, they are, you know, being installed as the rulers. You know, so they give him this, they lay down the law here. But you notice how they're trying to get the people to take their energy and just direct it more appropriately. Right? These people are all sincere. So they say, and let this act be the sincere pledge. Right? Your sincerity is fine, okay? Just needs to be properly directed. So they didn't squash everything. They try to just take that energy and focus it towards its appropriate point of focus. You know, this adoration, you need to orate to the Father, not to us. Direct your voice to the Father, not to us. But put all of that sincere energy that you've built up, you know, behind it. Have that spiritual motivation behind it. It will actually reach the Father if you succeed in having a pure spiritual motivation behind it. The Eternal Son will pick up that and carry it to the Father. Yep.
It's interesting that they reacted differently than they did with Van. They didn't sweep Adam aside. I mean, they didn't say, "Oh, you're being too modest."
Yeah, again, you know, Adam and Eve have that leverage because, you know, they're so new. Van is, you know, this is Van, you know. Yeah, yada, 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 Van. Yeah, and again, it's like, you know, how, even though he's immortal, he's been around forever. Yeah.
He's familiar.
Yeah, so he's familiar, yeah. You know, we saw how Van was struggling to have enough command over the people, you know, in getting the garden put together. He's just too familiar. You know, and again, that's, you know, humans that want to take advantage of these tendencies in others, you know this dynamics, you know, you gotta grab it while the iron's hot, right? You know, I mean, you get the people spun up and you, you know, and they'll just do anything in the newness of that moment. But if you let it go on too long, it's like, you know, it loses its, you lose your command over them. And it's, and you know, and humans have developed all kinds of techniques to try to somehow maintain that newness so they can maintain that authority potential over others. And yeah, the physics of being a demagogue. all right. Let's see. What else we have there? You know, at the end there, you know, Adam and Eve modeling for them, kind of in the same way that Jesus would model prayer, even though often he, you know, he'd already kind of been grown up through the ladder of prayer and through thanksgiving to worship and was kind of beyond that. I mean, the people he was around weren't, and so he would, you know, he would model the rudimentary, you know, beginnings for them. Let's see. Anything else there that caught your eye? All right, let's keep going.
And this was the origin of the Sabbath day tradition. Always in Eden, the seventh day was devoted to the noontide assembly at the temple. Long it was the custom to devote this day to self-culture. The forenoon was devoted to physical improvement, the noontime to spiritual worship, the afternoon to mind culture, while the evening was spent in social rejoicing. This was never the law in Eden, but it was the custom as long as the Adamic administration held sway on earth.
Okay, fairly straightforward. You know, do you appreciate what why it says, and this was never the law in Eden? I mean, that should remind you of something. Law, something about the Sabbath and a law. Oh, yeah, that commandment, right? Remember the Sabbath day and keep it holy. Okay, they didn't, you know, they'll tell us, you know, in a little while here in this paper that Adam and Eve didn't add that commandment to the seven of Dalmatia, right? That, but they're pointing out, right, that the events of this day go forward in time to the point where Moses has a commandment specifically about the Sabbath day, you know, in increasing it from 7 to 10. Okay, that's what they're getting at there between the lines. But it was very much a solid custom. And, you know, and as they'll tell us at the end of the paper, you now have the full set of 7 days. And so that 7-day week that the prince's staff started up, you know, long, long before, you know, this, got very definitively cemented now. And keeping up the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 count that humans have been doing for 500,000 years got a booster shot here, right? And got turned into basically, you know, a sacred fact by Adam and Eve's not planned booster shot on the 7-day week here.
Yeah. What
is self-culture,
do you think?
Oh, just, you know, a little bit, you know, the foundations of what we were talking about just a little bit ago. I mean, just you as an individual becoming more attuned to the cosmos, right? To having the cosmos, having a cosmic culture in your inner life. You know, self-control.
Can we start the day like this? So what would it be?
Well, you're getting a little sense. I mean, it starts out with the basics, physical improvement.
But self-culture is first, so like, what would you do?
So, what, you know, remember there's a, you know, everything has a threefold. So, if you want, you want to have a well-rounded self-culture, right, there has to be, you know, matter, mind, spirit, individuality, associativity, unity. Right, do you remember that triplet? There's health, sanity, happiness. Right, that's a well-rounded self-culture.
Do you have any examples of...
Well, you see, you're seeing devoted to physical improvement. That's the health part. Right? And it's just, you know, you notice the mind culture there.
I thought it was a separate thing, so you're saying it's encompassing things.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
The self-culture.
That makes sense. I thought it was a, get up in the morning and do self-culture.
No, and then you do then you do jumping jacks, and then you know.
Right.
You know.
Okay, good. I'm glad.
Right.
That's your self-culture.
Right.
But, you know, you can see how, like I was stressing, how you can, all those details would be in the context. You're trying to have health, sanity, and happiness. And, you know, remember when they tell you that, they'd say, and humans know very little of happiness. You're going, well, wait a minute, my dog is happy. What do you mean I know nothing of happiness? No, your dog can't be happy. That's impossible. Only a human can be happy. Your dog is satisfied or excited or something, okay? But, you know, remember, we always get to that. I mean, how, you know, joy is a spiritual experience, but happiness is a choice, right? The only way you can be happy is to be exposed to a negative stimulus and to choose to respond positively to that negative stimulus. Then and only then do you experience a sublime pleasure in your mind called happiness, right? That you are not a helpless victim of antecedent causation. You have free will, right? You can choose the state of your mind. It doesn't have to be imposed upon you. You don't have to be limited to an imposition upon you like that. Joy is just, you got a positive environment, you get positive unity environment, and there's a feeling that you have, a positive feeling that you have, you know, a positive response, you know, to a positive stimulus. That's joy. And happiness is transcendent of that. And can only be done by a person. The Paradise Trinity can't be happy. A thought adjuster can't be happy. And, that kind of transcendent, right? Using your personality.
Can I have a lone native be happy?
Yes, because they're a person. you go, well, where's the negative stimulus?
Because they have the, right, yeah.
Right. It's like, remember, I mean, the you go, how did it work before the super universe? But see, once you have people streaming in, right, there's a contrast. Okay. And then, right, you don't have just perfect surroundings then. And so, right. Yep. All right, let's see. We get everything else there. I mentioned about the... Yeah, and so like I said, the final section in this paper comes back to this whole bit of the creation story, you know, in 7 days. Okay, what else do we have here? This next section starts out with a question that we've been waiting for the answer to here for a long time. What about the Melchizedeks? How long are they going to hang around? Okay.
5, Adam's administration. For almost 7 years after Adam's arrival, the Melchizedek receivers remained on duty. The time finally came when they turned the administration of world affairs over to Adam and returned to Gerizim.
Okay, so just that one little statement. See, it's a paragraph to itself because it is this question, like I said, is what we've been looking for. So even though, as we talked about, you know, the Melchizedeks would have, you know, had at least strong suspicions that there were going to be issues right after the first day. Adam and Eve were already struggling with the contrast between their vast life of experiences in this dark place. They didn't, you know, hang around for 1,000 years or something just to kind of make sure, just only 7 years. But you go, well, yeah, but it was 7 years. See, again, you know, they were trying to kind of bias it a little bit, give them as much, you know, help, but they know that they're not supposed to be the primary influence on the world.
Yeah.
Right? They need to get off the stage relatively quickly. So, so it's just almost 7 years, and they're out of there. And we're going to get a little bit more physics here in this next paragraph.
The farewell of the receivers occupied the whole of a day. And during the evening, the individual Melchizedeks gave Adam and Eve their parting advice and best wishes. Adam had several times requested his advisors to remain on earth with him, but always were these petitions denied. The time had come when the material sons must assume full responsibility for the conduct of world affairs. And so, at midnight, the seraphic transports of Satania left the planet with 14 beings for Gerasim. The translation of Van and Amadon occurring simultaneously with the departure of the 12 Melchizedeks.
Okay, so the final physics there we'll get to in a second. But just, can you feel the unspoken tail of that end of that one statement? The time had come when the material sons must assume full responsibility for the conduct of world affairs. Then you could put a comma there, for better or for worse.
Yeah.
Right. That's the way it is. It's an evolutionary process. It's not the job of the government on the earth or the government on high to guarantee a positive outcome for you. Right? They certainly aren't supposed to guarantee you happiness or especially not guarantee you joy. Right? It just, you know, the right to pursue happiness. Yeah. And what I was just saying about happiness should remind you, it's like, whoa, wait a minute. If they're going to make sure that I have the opportunity to be happy, they have to make sure that there's some negativity in the environment. Yeah. Doesn't that flip the government's relationship to that right on its head? You know, once you actually know the proper meaning of the word happiness. Mm-hmm. Right?
Or the potential for negativity.
Yeah,
you said
right.
In some other places.
That sure.
You don't necessarily have to.
Yeah, but again, right, I mean, evil is necessary. Sin and you know, iniquity, no. Right, but the contrast of evil, right, you know, and again, that should remind you, oh yeah, that's true in general. Those inevitabilities, that's the whole point of the inevitabilities. Right? All those positive responses they're holding up there in the inevitabilities are in response to a negative stimulus.
Yep.
Right? None of those positive things can result except in response to those negative stimuli that each are enumerated in each of those points. That's the whole, that's the whole point of being a human, is to respond positively to a negative stimulus. And the degree to which things have settled in on a world where there isn't appropriate negative stimuli for human manifestation, the forces that be will see to it that the negative stimulus knob is turned up. Right? So that's, you know, what do they tell you about seraphim and adjusters in that regard? Oh, I would really love to have, you know, some stimulus from my angels. Be careful what you ask for. Right, their job is to lead you in troublous ways.
Yeah. They do that plenty of
times. So, right, again, it's not because they're mean. It's because they want to give you the opportunity to be human. And you can only be human in contrast to a lesser, right? To effectively a negative environment. Okay.
So
Melchizedek's
deep transport.
Yeah, that's okay. Right. So, yeah, I mean, so let's get to the physics.
Pretty high.
This is where you see it very directly. I mean, you've heard me say this many times that, you know, when we're talking about like the Melchizedek's, you know, it's like, well, it looks like it took him 5 years. You know, and okay, so that means it must be 15 light years away. And people always say, well, how do you know that Melchizedek's can't transport themselves at a very high speed? Right here. All right, there's 14 transport seraphim.
Yeah.
All right, Melchizedek's can't transport themselves. Okay, so that's one of the important physics details, if you will, there in that statement. The other is in the realm of mysteriousness. Okay, again, they don't explain. They just use that, basically that kind of religiousized word like translate.
Yeah.
Okay. The translation of Van and Amidon. Okay. Now with Van, you know, we kind of can understand this. Like, okay, we know that there's a whole Marantia body, right? That's in association with his physical body there. Okay, so they just, because that, you know, he came like that, right? And he was put, came from Gerasim as a Marantia being, okay? And then he was, put into some sort of coordination with a physical body, right? They just have to de-coordinate him, and vaporize the body or whatever. And stick his Marantia form into transport seraphim. Okay, well, what about Amidon? Okay. Now,
who probably had a photoduster, right?
Right. I was just going to bring that up. See, so, right, you know, Amidon has a thought adjuster. Okay, and you go, well, wait a minute. He's been around for 450,000 years. Why isn't he fused? Oh, that reminds you. Yeah, there's a special thing going on there. The adjuster's not being allowed to fuse with these, these individuals that are here long-term like that. But he has been right at the point of fusion for hundreds of thousands of years, okay? So we're talking about an individual with a very advanced, a well-grown soul. I mean, someone who a lot of his consciousness is literally the consciousness of that Marantia self that he has access to in his adjutant mind. Right? I mean, he's intellectually, he's essentially a Marantia, individual like Van is, in many ways. Okay? But, he doesn't have a whole Marantia body. So, I mean, it is just going to be his soul that's transported, his Marantia brain, if you will, that's transported just the way yours is going to be. This is no embryonic soul. This is, a very advanced Marantia object of some sort, right? That
could have fused right after he got there.
Yeah, so I mean, most likely, as soon as he gets to the mansion world or wherever, he's taken. Yeah, he's going to fuse. Yeah, yeah.
Another curious thing: they say plural seraphic transports, but I don't see an indication that it's a one-to-one correlation.
But remember, they tell you that you can a seraphic transport can only carry one being. And you know, when they talk about seraphic transport, so you got to put that together.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah, you don't have that right here, but yeah, there's no seraphic transport buses, right, or vans, or you know, it's just one individual, you know, because again, remember, it's this extremely intimate. I mean, it's like you're melting into this transport seraphim in a way. I mean, you know, you're just energetically kind of getting infused into them. Right? And then when you get to your destination, you're distilled out of them. Right? Yeah, I mean, it's a very intimate, you know, singular being. You know, see, so you think about that, if you're kind of like melting, if you had 10 people in there, they'd all melt together. That's not going to work, right? See?
Yeah.
Yeah. So... Yeah, it's so yeah, so you know that you've got 14 transport seraphim. Okay, so you know, here, you know, unlike when the transport seraphim are going to arrive in a while after the default and take the kids away, you know, all those kids have to be dematerialized, you know, that whole rigmarole, just like Adam and Eve when they were brought here. You know, that's a whole complicated process. They would have to have all kinds of advanced technology, you know, set up here to, like they have that dematerialization installation on Gerizim, you know. You know, I mean, you know, that was a very complicated process to haul all of them off the planet. But with Van and Amidon, you know, other than how they unravel the bodies, right, there's Marantia stuff there that just can be put in the transport, so... Yeah. So the spirit of the word, using the word translate, is, you know, they're being quote unquote translated from a material to a morontial energy system, right? And that's being transported. Yeah. Yeah. Whereas you don't have that with the Melchizedeks, you know, they're not talking about them being translated. See, it's only when you have this kind of change of energy nature that they use that word translate like that. All right.
All went fairly well for a time on Urantia, and it appeared that Adam would eventually be able to develop some plan for promoting the gradual extension of the Edenic civilization. Pursuant to the advice of the Melchizedeks, he began to foster the arts of manufacture with the idea of developing trade relations with the outside world. When Eden was disrupted, there were over 100 primitive manufacturing plants in operation, and extensive trade relations with the nearby tribes had been established.
So that little tidbit, besides the basic facts, immediately is kind of bringing you back to the point of what's going on. You know, and then they set up this wonderful spiritual temple and everything. You know, it's science. Remember, they're here to really establish science. You know, so technology and trade and right and all that. I mean, that's their main focus normally.
That was their Henry Ford or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
That was that long ago. You know, that was amazing.
Yeah.
So you've said many times about.
Yeah.
By now, if they had stayed. We'd have a whole different society.
Yeah. Right, right. You just can't even imagine, you know, what kind of sophisticated technology we would have had for 12,000 years now, you know, if they hadn't defaulted. And just here, you know, you'd think, I mean, it's not just technology, you know, but the whole material commerce of the planets, he would have been at this incredibly sophisticated level. I mean, who knows what... You know, what kind of a science of economics we would have now, too. I mean, what kind of, you know, concepts of how to relate to each other materially in an economic fashion we would have developed. See, we wouldn't have just advanced particle physics, right? I mean, we would have advanced, you know, economics is a science. We would have this advanced economic theory and stuff. And
sausage.
See, just all kinds of things, see.
Not just sausage.
Yeah. So,
if you had to have a good old days item, on your list. That's as close as you get. Mm-hmm. That was the good old days. That little time when it went fairly well.
Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah.
That was it.
There was 100 years. There was 100 years when all was reasonably well in an evolutionary sense on your ranch. But it was just this little flash, 100 years, and then poof. Yep. Yeah. So, I mean, again, you know, remember I said it earlier, they tell us we can't even imagine what kind of a society you have on a planet normally in the post-bestowal age. See, like, and I'm trying to stress that. I mean, don't think so selfishly about that statement. The way humans would interact with one another would just be completely beyond our imagination, how you would coordinate material interactions and stuff. We can't even imagine that system.
How many years would have that cut off of how we ended up? It would have been a huge 25,000 years or 50,000 years of progress. Lost or something.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, yeah, that's the, you know, the Adam and Eve are normally a 25,000 year affair. So, like I was saying, from 35,000 BC to 10,000 BC, and right, they would have really done all of their basic stuff.
We would have had 10,000 plus on that.
Yeah, see, and we would have 12,000 years now, basically, of living, you know, see, so obviously, you know, if that had happened, you know, you wouldn't have gotten. You know, very unlikely, right, that you would have gotten Michael coming here, right? The magisterial son would have come, mm-hmm. you know, back then. And
yeah.
Yeah. So it would have been Jesus very different. Right, you wouldn't have had the third epical revelation, right? That wouldn't, yeah.
An emergency. If yeah. He was last, he'll be first.
Yeah. So yeah. It would have been very, very different.
Waving the flag.
Yeah, remember, in supremacy, there are no coincidences. You know, when all is said and done, everything is just exactly as it was supposed to be. Yeah.
The thing that wouldn't, if things had gone that way, what wouldn't be here?
Us. Yeah. Yeah. There certainly wouldn't have been the kind of biologic, you know, creatures that we are, you know, on this planet, you know, still. Yeah. Okay, keep going.
For ages, Adam and Eve had been instructed in the technique of improving a world in readiness for their specialized contributions to the advancement of evolutionary civilization. But now they were face to face with the pressing problems, such as the establishment of law and order in a world of savages, barbarians, and semi-civilized human beings. Aside from the cream of the Earth's population assembled in the garden, only a few groups here and there were at all ready for the reception of the Adamic culture.
Yeah, see, so they're, you know, reminding you of the technical thing that's weighing on them and getting them dispirited. And it's just, there's, you know, it's like college professors having to teach grade school and junior high and high school before they can actually teach their students at the college level, right? And how frustrating that is. You know, you've got this college freshman and they can't read, they can't write, you know, they can't add and subtract. And supposedly they graduated from 12th grade, right?
They didn't know everything.
Yeah. Yeah, so, right, I mean, they're just overwhelmed by how much, you know, remedial stuff, you know, they have in play, and it starts to set up this tension, you know, their spiritual idealism, right, wants to get on to what they're really about, but they can't. And it's going to take us so long to get to that. You know, they start to, you know, what do we want to do our job? When do we want to do it now? Right? That tension is building in them.
Yeah, they, impatient.
Right. That impatience. Mm-hmm. Right. That's the fundamental poison of default is impatience, right? What was that?
It opened the door to you know
yeah,
who.
Right. Yep. Yeah. Yeah, so...
what kind of beings did they have that they could, like, hang out with and talk to on their level? Like, the midwayers?
They got, yeah, they have primary midwayers, they've got seraphim, they've got cherubim, they've got, you know, that lesser order of angels. There's probably all kinds of other beings.
And no Melchizedek's?
The Melchizedek's have all gone, you know. But, you know, there would be visitors that would come to the world, you know, celestial visitors. And, yeah, so, see, that's the thing, you know, it's just like with us. When someone gets so dispirited, they say, you know, I'm all alone. No one even knows I exist. You know, it's like, well, not quite. Okay, you've got people all around you. For instance, you have a family that loves you, you know, and, you know, maybe, you know, or friends. Or how about God? How about the thought adjuster from God that lives within you? And it's like, you're not alone, right? But humans can, you know, there's none so blind as those who will not see. Right? And then Adam and Eve are slipping into that, you know, deciding that they're just all alone. It's like, no, you're not. Right, but it starts to appear that way, and they forget the difference between appearance and reality. It appears that they're all alone, but they aren't really, and they have to remind themselves of that. You're really not all alone.
You can tell because they requested them, because don't leave.
Yeah.
They weren't quite comfortable with just who was going to be left.
Yeah.
There were just two life carriers, weren't there?
Right. Yeah, you got the you know more than that. You've got two senior life carriers plus all their assistants.
Hey, thanks a lot, guys. We're the
yeah. What am I? Chop liver? Yeah. See again, like I said, see they're not alone. It's a self-blinding. See, so again, that's why this is relevant. It's not just, you know, informing you the history of the planet.
It would appear even to me, or anyone, it's a daunting thing. I
mean, it is a daunting thing.
It's not going to be easy.
Not going to be easy.
It's going to be quick.
But all they need is patience. And everything will be okay. Yeah. They can't do that one simple favorable condition.
It wasn't quick enough for them. Let's do this.
Yeah. The other little thing in there is, you know, nothing's changed, right? On this planet right now, you need to face the fact we're not all born equal. There are savages, barbarians, and at best, semi-civilized human beings. That's our spectrum still today. Despite how politically incorrect it is to even think of calling someone a savage or a barbarian. Okay.
How about a little monkey?
At best, we're semi-civilized, yes. All right. What else do they say here?
Adam made a heroic and determined effort to establish a world government. But he met with stubborn resistance at every turn. Adam had already put in operation a system of group control throughout Eden and had federated all of these companies into the Edenic League. But trouble, serious trouble, ensued when he went outside the garden and sought to apply these ideas to the outlying tribes. The moment Adam's associates began to work outside the garden, they met the direct and well-planned resistance of Kalagastia and Dalagastia. The fallen prince had been deposed as world ruler, but he had not been removed from the planet. He was still present on Earth and able, at least to some extent, to resist all of Adam's plans for the rehabilitation of human society. Adam tried to warn the races against Kalagastia, but the task was made very difficult because his archenemy was invisible to the eyes of mortals.
Okay, so, you know, the same problem we have today. If you can't see it, it doesn't exist. right? We still struggle with that. All I when I look at my body, all I see is matter. Therefore, that's all that's there. You know, I can't see this so-called mind. Therefore, mind doesn't exist, or you know, whatever you pick. You know, pick your favorite thing like that. You know, it's not just I can't see bacteria and viruses, therefore they don't exist. It's not just simple things like that. You know, in them telling about how he had been deposed as world ruler, but he had not been removed from the planet. He was still present on Earth and able, at least to some extent, to resist. You know, remember, there are rebel primary midwayers, and being able to do such things, right? I mean, right. So there is, you know, you don't have to have rebel secondary midwayers. You can have rebel primary midwayers. And there can be, you know, physical foolishness going on, physical manipulation of circumstances. Again, you're left to just, you know, speculate about this and imagine exactly what. But many strange things happened, right? They tell us that much. You know, humans are unwittingly being kind of manipulated, you know, to Calendal's ends. You know, there's machinations going on.
So at this time, is Lucifer still around?
Well, Satan would be occasionally dropping by for a visit.
Where's Lucifer?
Lucifer is...
In jail?
No, I mean, he's not put in prison until Pentecost. You know, he's still, you know, fooling around on Gerizim and whatnot. But he doesn't travel. Satan is the one that travels.
But he's not ruling on Gerizim.
No, he's not ruling. But he's still going to the first mansion world and seeing if he can convince some new Marantia students to follow him instead of Laniforge.
So what I don't understand is if their credo was basically to circumvent time, you know, what do you want,
mm-hmm.
and make everything happen, you know, not by fiat, but just, you know, that way, why they totally lost all that then? Because if they were out to hinder Adam and Eve, you know, that was totally against what they were really trying to do. I mean, everything they tried to do fell apart. So, you know, they're really trying to speed things up, which they would do. You'd think they'd want to cooperate with that. But their sincerity just dropped.
No. See, the problem is they want to speed things up. Adam and Eve are, you know, they know that Adam and Eve have been debauched by this false teaching about how, no, everything has to be slow and synchronized with the, you know, the evolutionary process. Yes, like, you know, remember, they ridicule that whole notion. And so they're against them, you know.
Just in principle.
Right, and yeah, well, the way Adam and Eve are going to be, you know, not giving the people great disclosures. They're going to, remember how in a normal world, like we read, normally you have this very narrow bell curve of people, and they're moved along very slowly and methodically. You know, it's ages before, you know, anyone on the planet even knows that there's something beyond most highs.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. Just that they you know, Caligashian and Dalagashian know that they, you know, in their, from their point of view, Adam and Eve have been debauched by this whole false teaching, you know, that this is the way it should be. It's like, no. Self-assertion is the battle cry, you know, just go for it, and, you know, and unbridled liberty, you know, why are you keeping these people in the dark? Why are you not letting them, you know, just go for it? And, you know, so, I mean, it's still a philosophic thing, but, I mean, you're correct to a degree that they're down this road a long ways, and so now there's just a lot of just really corrupted mentality, you know, in them.
There's no sincerity.
Yeah, well, yeah. I mean, they're just, you know, they're going to be less and less. Are they going to be able to hold a very kind of definitive, long-term view that you know, to their ends? They're going to be more and more just kind of opportunistic in the moment, just, you know, being annoying, rather than everything kind of part of some grand plan, right? They've gotten so corrupted that they can't really hold, you know, a grand plan in their mind anymore. Their mind would be so debased and kind of in the moment and opportunistic. Right? So they are a little bit more like our caricatures of evil beings, you know, where they're just, you know, fooling around in the moment.
Is that because they just are unraveling?
Yeah, they're just, the integrity of their minds is has been so corrupted. You know, remember that there's, you start with self-confusing, then you go to self-disrupting. See, when you get to that self-disrupting, see, that's what I was saying, it's harder and harder for you to maintain some sort of a big picture, long-term view of things, because your mind is just getting so fractured, so broken, so disrupted. You know, and then, of course, now they're fully in sin, so it's self-destroying.
Yeah.
Right? And so, you know, there's just all of the higher levels of integrity have just been completely erased, you know. And so it becomes harder and harder for them, see, to have any sort of a relationship to the cosmos, to the whole, and to think in that, like I said, that big picture sense and have this long-term, you know, thousand-year plan or whatever. You know, they're just getting so much animal-like and in the moment.
Well, you know, and every recognition they have of the whole
is flipped around 180 degrees, right? Yeah.
They oppose it. They resist it.
Right. Everything has gotten totally turned around, and yeah. So it's just, it's very confused now. But let's see. But you do notice, see. There's this tendency in Adam and Eve. You know, a lot of times they're not mentioning both of them, but me and both of them, to get ahead of themselves. It's like normally, see, they would come, you know, and there's this very definitive, centralized authority in the planetary prince. You know, that touches the whole world. You can have kind of a world government. You know, we're obviously not talking about light and life level of world government here, but you know, but you have this, you know, this influence from the prince's headquarters normally on a world that, you know, definitely touches everyone on the planet, and everyone is kind of in orbit about that fact, if you will. You know, and he's immediately thinking, you know, okay, I'm going to do that. You know, we're the world rulers. Let's really get our world ruler influence, you know, and setting up kind of a hierarchical thing, you know, hierarchical influence over the whole planet. It's like, no, yeah, you're getting way ahead of yourself. It's not going to work. I mean, even if you didn't have Kaligashi and Dalagashi messing things up, you know, you've got a lot of horizontal work to do before you bring in too much vertical structure into this. People are not ready for that yet.
Do you think they would have influenced, but trouble, serious trouble, you know, which they obviously recognized as soon as they started to do that.
Yeah.
You know, as bright as they were, so to speak, and as trained, you'd think they'd say, well, you know, our hour has not come. So
well, you'll see. That does come in. You know, okay. They do bring that in. But they have to learn by leaping, right? See, it's interesting that they didn't kind of foresee that as much as you'd think that they would have. It's like, because they're still kind of having a hard time adjusting to all of this remedial stuff that they have to do.
Yeah.
Right? They're wanting to just kind of assume, like is appropriate normally, that that's all in place and now you can just build upon that. And it's like, no, that's not there. You've got to build the first floor, right, first. Okay.
Even among the Edenites, there were those confused minds that leaned toward the Kaligashtra teaching of unbridled personal liberty, and they caused Adam no end of trouble. Always were they upsetting the best-laid plans for orderly progression and substantial development. He was finally compelled to withdraw his program for immediate socialization. He fell back on Van's method of organization, dividing the Edenites into companies of 100 with captains over each and with lieutenants in charge of groups of 10.
Okay, see, like I said, see, he does fallbacks. Okay, yeah. It's not going to work. But again, you see, notice when they're talking about inside, you know, with this, you know, sort of the cream of the crop humans, you know, that are in the garden, upsetting the best laid plans for orderly progression and substantial development. See, again, that unbridled personal liberty. Way too slow. Yeah. See, orderly progression. Yeah, no, let's just go for it, right? Take off the bridle and let the spirit run free, right? It's just such an insidious thought that Caligastia put in everyone's minds. And it's in the air you breathe still today. As soon as you were born, that started creeping into your thought, polluting your relationship with your spiritual energy. Thinking that somehow it's innately divine and bridles are evil and it should just be let to run free like a Mustang on the open range. No, spirit energy needs a very solid bridle with strong reins, and it should never be let to run free. As soon as Jesus saw his disciples, you know, came down on like a ton of bricks, dropped a big boulder on top of them so that they couldn't move, right? Lest they go squirting off. Because that spirit energy is very double-edged sword. Right? I mean, there isn't, danger's not possible until there's spirit energy in play. Because danger is domination, right? How is your mind going to be dominated if there isn't something above mind in play? Right? The only thing that can dominate mind energy is spirit energy. Right? So there is no real danger until there is spirit energy in play. And the instant there is, you have just as much creativity potential as you do destructivity potential. So
that's really shot through with recognition of that, because it doesn't matter what facet of this story you look at. Don't let it even get a little foothold here. Yeah. Like, secondary, primary midwires taking action the way they did. Yeah, you need to get there before now, if we can.
And again, I'll just stress, when they say orderly progression, you should immediately be thinking about the third principle of the Lucifer Manifesto, right? Which, to sum it up in crude terms, Lucifer said, orderly schmorderly. Okay, that's the third principle of the Lucifer Manifesto, right? That's a bunch of baloney that you have to, somehow put yourself, limit yourself to this whole ordered scheme, yada, yada, yada. That's what he's rejecting that. It's like, no, just let her rip. What do we want? Light and life. When do we want it now? Turn the volume up to 13.
Right? Forget that orderly thing. It's more like orgy. Think orgy.
Right.
Introduce you to something.
Right. You know, right after they give you the three principles, they say, what did you get? Obviously, you didn't get order because it was rejected. So what do you get? The orgy of darkness and death.
Yeah. Turn you guys on to something really cool. You're
going
to love it.
Yeah. So, see, that's what they're trying to... they're just reminding you that all these energies are in play. And Adam and Eve have to try to somehow manage that, to give them enough that they feel like they're striving for their ideals, right, that are burning inside of them, but try to somehow keep them, stay between the lines. And they could have done it, but see, they couldn't stay between the lines.
Yeah.
Yeah. In order to keep all the people between the lines, see, they had to be rock solid, like Van and Amidon, and never go outside the lines.
They had to take that negative stimuli that was brewing all around them.
And it should have sobered them even more, reminding them the fact that everyone was trying to squirt out and go in every... it's like, boy, we really have to be rock solid here,
yeah.
Right? If we give an inch, they're going to take a mile. It should have gotten them clear on that. But anyway.
But of course, Ben was here for 450,000 years.
Yeah.
To be here for a short time, I don't care who you are, you could just fall apart like they did. I mean, they were here for how many years?
Yeah.
Before it started falling apart.
7 days.
You can see it, though. Like, it's shocking. Man had a long time to adjust
but,
to it.
But again, remember, if the rebellion had occurred on the first day that the prince and his staff arrived, Van would have stood unmoved.
Yeah, see what
you're saying about that's the thing. You know, remember, the Most High's picked Van and the other nine in his group so that they could have withstood a rebellion on the first day. They had it within them. They didn't need any more experiential acquirement. Hmm. They had it innately to begin with.
But Adam and Eve didn't. I wonder if any of the material sons and daughters would have had that.
Yeah, we remember we talked about that. It's pretty likely that no matter who they would have sent.
Unless the Supreme, like we were saying too, wanted it to be more how it happened.
In supremacy, there could have been a conspiracy of circumstances and whatnot that could make it somehow come out, but just thinking about it analytically, it's pretty hard to imagine that, you know, any of them would have made it.
Yeah. The Anglo-Saxons invaded Britain.
When the Anglo-Saxons, invaded Britain,
Britain, they still had that 100. They still organized themselves in the sets of 100. They called it the 100 Moot.
That's a great little tidbit. That reminds you of how much Andite influence coming down from Adam and Eve got injected into Northern Europe. And held to recent times. So it's not just the stories in Genesis, a lot of these things made huge impressions, and the more Andite influence, the more likely it is that it'll be there. Like I've, mentioned to people, you basically have the story of Adamson and Rada that we'll read about in a few papers, still in the origin myths and those northern European peoples, those Nordic peoples, right? They, through the Andites, they kept the basic essence of, of the progenitors of the secondary midwayers and the progenitors of the mortals and... So that stuff got remembered, very religiously, like the 7 days, it became a holy thing, right? So the 100 thing became a holy thing, and so it was religiously followed for thousands of years. All right, I think we got everything there. Yep, keep going.
Adam and Eve had come to institute representative government in the place of monarchical, but they found no government worthy of the name on the face of the whole earth. For the time being, Adam abandoned all effort to establish representative government, and before the collapse of the Edenic regime, he succeeded in establishing almost 100 outlying trade and social centers where strong individuals ruled in his name. Most of these centers had been organized aforetime by Van and Abaddon.
Yeah, so initially it's like, 100 centers, and then you're right, what was it? It was like 61, wasn't it, or something like that? If you go back to, planning the garden... Yeah, 61 far-scattered settlements, Van and Abaddon were recruiting people from. If Van and Abaddon hadn't, Adam and Eve wouldn't have really accomplished much of anything. But there you see, they're thinking, okay, civilization has definitively evolved to the monarchical stage, and in we come, and we, this is what we were reading, and we take it forward. No. They don't even, you know, there isn't even a reasonable monarchy anywhere on the planet yet. Yeah. And so Adam, you know, gets some individuals to basically, you know, and send them out to become kings, you know, declare themselves to be kings and to be serving by divine right. Right? See, in the name of Adam, I serve, I rule over you. Right? And so he got that started. And so, yeah, the divine right thing, you know. He definitely got a serious juicing there that carried it forward to you know, present time. Because we may have forgotten a lot of the Dalmatia stuff, but, you know, we remember a lot of stuff from Adam and Eve, even though it was 38,000 years ago. Okay, one final little comment here.
The sending of ambassadors from one tribe to another dates from the times of Adam. This was a great forward step in the evolution of government.
See, so they just throw in one other little footnote about what we were just saying. Right? There's just so many things that were carried forward because basically we came to think that God told us to do that. And so, so we very religiously sent ambassadors from one tribe to another, you know, going forward from that. Just how influential Adam and Eve were in setting up some of these basic ways that we think about government, think about interacting with one another. So even though the fault, you know, the fact that they were so revered, right, it was helpful. Right? It's like you just have, you know, the tiny little handful of Andites that make it across the Pacific over to South America. But they had this incredible cultural impact on Central and South America. You know, and it wasn't just because, sort of automatically because of genetic uplift. It was just they were so, such an amazing phenomenon, right? These majestic, advanced thinkers, you know, builders and stuff. I mean, the people just, you know, religiously followed them forward for, you know, for centuries and millennia, you know, and you end up with, you know, Aztec pyramids and Mayan pyramids and, you know, and Machu Picchu and all that sort of stuff, right? All because of just had a profound cultural impact they had. So Adam and Eve really got that going, that incredibly profound, lasting cultural impact, even though the direct genetic influence was quite limited. All right. Well, we'll keep rolling next time. We'll actually start to get a little bit into those kind of details as they talk about, as you can see, you know, home life, life in the garden. It starts to get be a little bit like reading The Government on a Neighboring Planet, you know, and giving us some examples of, well, here's how they set up an educational system. And so we'll, you know, it'll give us a little bit of that kind of reflect.
The same thing they did when the prince first got here.
Yeah, yeah.
What it's supposed to be like.
So you can see what examples they were trying to set, and obviously we could still follow those examples today now that they've been, you know, told us again. All right, let's take a moment here, everyone.